Vladimir Putin gets pretty serious when it comes to drone attacks, and so do Russian security forces. This, including these incredible pictures I'm about to share with you, is what you need to know today.
We will respond in kind, but several times more powerfully. The enemy will feel that.
Yeah, those are tough words and tough action. This is the effect. Let's do this. Hey there, I'm Rick Sanchez, and we have some video that we're going to start with today that I want you to look at because it's kind of crazy. This is a bust. Watch. Those are drones you're looking at right there. This happened just a couple of days ago. The drone, not just drones, by the way, those are drones with explosives that were about to be fired into Moscow. And this is a warehouse in Moscow or in the Moscow region, right? Apparently, these are drones. They were smuggled into Russia with the help, of course, of European countries because they wanted these drones to be used to attack Russia. Now, watch this. Look at this. This is the FSB guys, basically the FBI for Russia. Look at this. Those are the agents. They're going in, they're raiding the facility as they learned that the drones were on the verge of being launched. They'd been staking out the warehouse, apparently, monitoring the smugglers' calls and their movements. The drones were equipped with Canadian-made AI control, Canadian-made modules. Interestingly enough, they were used with electronic-resistant warfare. In other words, they couldn't be knocked out electronically like most drones can, so they were specialized. These drones also had C4 plastic explosives, about 2 pounds of dynamite, and they were made in the United States. Okay, now watch this. So these are FSB agents now. These are some bad hombres, as they say, and they're going in to make the bust. Yeah, that's gunfire. One of the guys who was the mastermind, there he is there, obviously, he's blurred. They took him out as they made more arrests of some of the suspects, but that's inside. Now I want to show you some video outside as well. Let's go back outside of the building and I'll show you some more busts. Okay, this is outside of the warehouse where they're arresting other people who were there. Some of them were obviously culpable and responsible. Others were workers and didn't know what the drones would be used for, they will say. Is it possible that they didn't know? Highly unlikely, given the fact that if you're living in Moscow, there's drone attacks that's in the news every day. They've become pretty common. The drones themselves are part of the everyday vernacular in the city. And if you live here or anywhere near here, you would probably know. Everyone seems to know exactly what they are and where they are and what they're used for. So why didn't they call the police if they were working in a factory where they were making drones? Look, regardless, not my place to judge. But the fact is this. Attacks like this one that was thwarted in that video, have become more and more common in Russia, right? Interestingly enough, the Russian president, Mr. Putin, just talked about this the other day. In fact, what Mr. Putin said is something that I've never heard him say before. And what he's addressing is the fact that European governments, and to a lesser extent, the United States government, are now attacking Russia directly. Yes, Europe is presently attacking Russia. In other words, they used to give Ukraine a lot of money and a lot of weapons and a lot of training and a lot of guidance so that they could try and win the war on the front lines against Russia. But that hasn't been working, right? Because Russia is continuing to advance along the front lines, despite what you might see on CNN or the BBC, which is just the opposite in their reports. In fact, look, the bottom line is, when was the last time Ukraine had a real victory? 224? 2024 was Kursk, right? And that was later taken back by the Russians. That was the last time Ukraine scored what can even be, or what I would describe as a significant military victory on the actual battlefield, and that was quite a while ago. And that is why, as we've reported and documented, Europe's leaders, along with NATO and the European Union, have chosen to de-emphasize the fighting on the front lines and instead emphasize bombing infrastructure, bombing civilian targets inside of Russia. Listen to this.
Since last year, a decision was to remove all the military production from Ukraine to Europe, which was done efficiently. More than a month ago, Russian Ministry of Defense published a list of all these factories who, in fact, in Europe, producing armaments for the Ukrainian army. So think of this. They are the logistics, their industries are now in Europe.
Yeah, that's Viktor Boot. And it's interesting, as he's talking to Tucker, their stated goal, as he explains, is to try and weaken Russia by hitting Russian energy facilities as well as Russian civilian targets. So now that you know the background on that, let me tell you what the President Putin has said about that this week. He announced that henceforth he will meet every one of those attacks with, quote, and this is his word, mirrored attack. But those attacks, he says, will be more powerful. In fact, here he is explaining just that.
Our responses will always be reciprocal, no matter where they attempt to strike on the territory of the Russian Federation. We will respond in kind, but several times more powerfully. The enemy will feel that. They are already feeling it, I hope, and will continue to feel it with growing intensity going forward.
Let me tell you about something. This is my read of that man, Mr. Putin, since I've been here as a journalist covering him, who happens to be the head of state here, right? My take... following him, watching him, being in a meeting with him. He's not a braggadocious type. He's not a chest thumper, right? In fact, he's generally he's kind of a restrained guy. When he talks, he uses very exact language when he describes strategies, for example. So the fact that he's suddenly talking with confidence about the Russian operation in Ukraine, that's something you should take note of, right? It's noteworthy. Now, you should also know this. The Russian people are disgusted by what they see. They're disgusted with Europe. They're disgusted with Ukraine's attacks on civilian targets in their communities. They're disgusted seeing schools and buses and railroads hit and apartment buildings that have been hit by drones and where people have been killed. And they're especially frustrated about the attacks on the oil facilities. Who wouldn't be, right? That are making them have to wait at gas stations to fill up their gas pumps, right? To fill up their gas tanks, I should say. And yeah, look, that's all true, and it is an inconvenience. But when you examine that inconvenience historically or contextually, those hardships they pale in comparison to what Russians have suffered in the past, if you know anything about Russia's history, right? Or even if you just compare it to what other citizens have to deal with, let's say even in Western countries. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Right? Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. The West is constantly trying to frame Russia as a very dangerous place to live. You heard Zelensky do it the other day when he was talking to Trump. Oh, I wouldn't go there. It's dangerous because of those drones, right? But is it really dangerous, comparatively speaking? I want to do something for you. Let's look at the danger of drone violence in Russia, which exists, compared with the danger of gun violence in my country, in the United States. So, here's the numbers. So far this year, 250 people have been killed by drones. This is according to UN figures where I got this, right? And that's terrible, of course. 250 people dead is terrible, especially if some of them are children. But now let's look at how many people in the United States are shot. How many people in the United States are shot or killed by rampant gun violence? Comparisons. Look at this. This is stark. Every day in the United States, 327 people are shot. Of those, 117 are killed. And of those, 23 of them are children. So look at the numbers again. 250 people killed so far from drone violence in Russia. 117 are killed every day in the U.S. I know that number's not there, but it's 117 people are killed every day from shootings in the United States. And by the way, in the United States, there are statistically more guns than there are people, which kind of explains that. So if the plan is to weaken Russia by making it a dangerous country that is gripped by fear and unable to grow and unable to prosper because everyone's sitting around like this, then according to, again, Mr. Putin, that is not working.
The aggressive part of the so-called collective West is fighting against us, while we are developing our economy, strengthening our finances, modernizing our armed forces, achieving new results in the defense industry, and moving forward. Our guys, our fighters, are advancing.
So Putin is probably right about that, but that's not going to stop Europe. Even as I sit here today, I looked at the headlines and I see that more European leaders in different countries are talking about wanting a war with Russia. It's crazy. Look at this one. This is Lithuania. So Lithuania's foreign minister, for example, is now talking how NATO should be leveling Russian military bases. Look at this, all right? Foreign minister says NATO could level Russia's military bases in Kaliningrad. I mean, this Kaliningrad. This is nuts. So in light of this, I want to share something with you now. I want to share something with you that was explained to me by a friend of mine. Rustam and I are two old guys who hang out together on weekends and, you know, we play a little golf together. I'm American, he's Russian, and he's a very proud Tatar, right? His story is kind of sad, but it's fitting right now. So I want to share it with you, especially given what Europe is doing in Russia right now by threatening Russia and targeting civilians. He wrote me a story, and what he wrote to me is a story that happened right after World War II that I didn't know about. And it's a story the world has forgotten, but it's important. These are his words. He says that in 1946, Europe was barely crawling out of its nightmare. Suddenly, it tumbled headlong into another famine. The harvests there were scorched by drought. The granaries stood empty. The people who were celebrating the end of the war just yesterday there in Europe were now staring at empty bowls. And then upon the stage appeared hope. And it came from the Soviet Union. This is a country that lost 27 million of its own people in that same year, where agriculture lay in ruins and livestock herds had shrunk to a mere 45% of their pre-war numbers. Yes, that Soviet Union suddenly took it upon itself to feed Europe. And yes, you heard that correctly, my dear friend. This is what Rustam wrote to me. And I'm reading his stuff and I'm thinking, wow. He says, we were there to feed those whom we had earlier called our enemies. And now, with a straight face, we called them our brother nations. In fact, he shared the numbers with me. I checked. Here they are. I'll take you through it. I mean, it's not that boring, but it's interesting. Into Berlin alone, right, in Germany, which was the Soviet occupation zone, they sent 969,000 tons of grain, 60,000 tons of foodstuff, along with 50,000 head of cattle. Into Poland, the Soviets sent 900,000 tons of grain on credit, not to mention 60,000 tons of bread dispatched to Warsaw as a gift upon its liberation from the Nazis. Romania, having first received 150,000 tons of wheat and the same quality of corn, valued in tens of millions of dollars in today's money, received sums that could never be repaid. Czechoslovakia, teetering on the brink of catastrophe at the time, they were handed 600,000 tons of grain. Finland, 50,000 tons of rye. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. In total, between 1946 and 1947, the USSR shipped no less than 2.5 million tons of bread to Albania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Finland, France, and sundry other now ungrateful recipients. Impressive. Magnificent in many ways. It's a scene worthy of a historic account. It's a country in need, finding a way to share its resources with its neighbor. That's nice. But wait, because the story then changed. Because you know what happened after that? Here's what happened. Throughout the USSR, from Ukraine to the Volga River, suddenly, that same drought that had devastated Europe overwhelmed the Russian people. And here in Russia, it wasn't about empty granaries. It was about empty bellies. The Russian peasant, Rustam, explained to me, having surrendered his last loaf of the state's insatiable quotas, watched as their grain on trains disappeared, going to Europe. And as they did, they thought to themselves and they muttered with a peculiar fatalism, we would have had enough to eat for years if we hadn't sent all of this abroad. But this is how it is, wrote one. We eat rubbish now. They eat our bread and rolls in Europe. You know, those disheartened peasant farmers died in huge numbers. In all, from 1946 and 1947, between 1 to 2 million people died in what is now known as the Soviet famine. Can you imagine? 2 million people starved to death in the Soviet Union after giving so much of what even they didn't have so that they could feed Europe. By the way, this is my friend Rustem, who shared this story with me. There he is there in the middle. He's a typical Russian dudushka, right? Dudushka, with his wife Ludmila. That means granddad, by the way. With his wife Ludmila by his side and their children and their grandchildren that he adores, just like you love your kids and your grandkids, and I love my kids and my grandkids, because we're all the same all over the world. His is a hell of a story that he shared with me. I didn't know that. Did you know that? Did you know that the Russians had given to the Europeans to save them after World War II? I didn't know that. You see, I grew up in America, where I am taught to brag about the Marshall Plan. Of course, I now know that the Marshall Plan wasn't exactly what I was taught. It was the seeding of America's political and economic hegemony in many ways in the post-war era. It wasn't just a selfless gift, although it was a very nice thing to do. It was also a strategy designed to brilliantly serve the U.S.'s national interest for decades to come. As for Europeans, let me ask, do they care? Do they appreciate the story that Rustem shared with me? Do they even know that it was the Soviet army that liberated them from the Nazis, young Europeans today? Do they even know that it was the Russian peasants who died, 1 million, 2 million of them, so they can give them their grain and keep them alive? Do Europeans know this? The answer isn't just no. It's hell no. Of course not. Europe's leaders today seem especially bent on destroying Russia, war with Russia, breaking up Russia. What do they say about history? You forget your past, and you'll be doomed to relive it, right? One hopes not. But you know, since Russia is famous for its playwrights, I looked up a quote. Let me share with you what one of those famous playwrights wrote. Didn't grow up too far from my friend Rustem, by the way. It's Mikhail Lermontov. And this is what he wrote. He wrote the following. Sometimes you are forced to treat someone kindly. You try to love them. But then you discover that they repay you with treachery and with ingratitude. Hello, Europe. Are you there? Are you listening? When we come back, China is being told to stop buying oil from Russia. What is their response? In fact, there's a lot of news about China in the news today, as well as what's going on in Iran. By the way, remember, you can find us on the socials. You can find us on X and on Spotify. You can find us on YouTube. And we'll be right back. And hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. I know we were just talking, but I got more. I've got more that I want to share with you. Welcome back, by the way. So what we're trying to do right now is figure out exactly what's happening economically, what with the war in Iran, which is disaster in so many ways, the tariffs, China's actions as a result of the tariffs, Russia's rise on the energy front, if nothing else, India's independence. And then there's gold, and then there's silver, and then there's Bitcoin. And you know, there's almost a cross effect on all of these things. And you got to be pretty smart to try and figure this out from an economic standpoint. So we're joined now by David Morgan. He publishes the Morgan Report, and he's good enough to join us now. And one of the things he's probably going to do is try and talk me into buying silver. So we'll get to that point as well. But before we do that, David, hey, thanks so much for joining us, my friend. You know, you're very gracious to share so much of your time with us here.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
So let's start with the latest breaking news that we just received. It's about China. I don't know what your take is on this, but it's really interesting. China has just announced it's going to reduce its oil imports. I think we got this, right? Have we got this headline? China's reducing its imports, I think, by something like 40%. And they're doing it because they say they just want to be a good player. They're trying to lower energy prices to help other countries, and they think by reducing their own imports, they will help to regularize, I guess, the price of oil. What do you make of this, and what kind of effect might it have?
Well, it is true that they've lowered their consumption. There's a lot of reasons for it. First of all, they are experiencing slower economic growth, and of course, that reduces demand. Mm. Electric vehicles in China account for a very large share of the new vehicle sales, and that reduces petroleum consumption.
Huh.
Their petrochemical sector is weak, and the refining ability in China has declined somewhat. During the close of Hormuz, Beijing drew substantially from its enormous strategic oil reserves. They planned probably better than any other country on the planet. But they're still being drawn down. Estimates suggest that China's accumulated 1.3 to 1.5 billion barrels of their strategic reserve over the last several years. Mm. So significantly, they are going to reduce consumption based on those factors, as well as politically jawboning or telling their citizenry, look, we've got to cut back.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, here's what's fascinating about this, because there's another part to this story, and that is that they're now getting most of their oil from Russia, which I think is really stupid. I don't know how you feel about this, but I think it's really stupid on the part of the Europeans. The Europeans are basically telling the Russians, who are like their next-door neighbors, oh, go to hell, we don't want your oil, you can keep your oil. So the Russians are like, okay, we'll sell it all cheap to China and India. So that's what they're doing. They're actually putting a pipeline in and sending their oil through Siberia, directly from Siberia to China. I'm sure you know about this because you watch this stuff. So now, apparently, the Trump administration is telling the Chinese, no, 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 you can't do that. Any of your companies that get oil from Russia are going to be punished with huge tariffs. And the Chinese are saying, no, you don't tell us who the hell we buy our oil from. So, you know, here we are in another tariff war, supposedly, that could be started soon with China. And I'm not so much interested in your political view of this. You know, anybody can have an opinion about this. I'm interested in your take on what effect this has on me, on my wife, your kids, on the average American consumer when we do this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Let me break it down. So China has been told, you know, not to import, and that is, you know, and they have not publicly agreed to do so. Mm-hmm. Separately, the U.S. imposed sanctions on major producers like Russia, Russia and other shipping entities. So China's state-owned oil companies temporarily reduced or suspended some of their seaborne purchases because they wanted to avoid violating sanctions or exposing themselves to financial risk. Mm-hmm. Let me break that up a little bit. You know, the biggest mess that we've really gotten into, and it's put the wars, you know, very much at the top, but the biggest part was when the war started in Ukraine, the U.S. basically stole $300 billion from Russia.
Yeah.
At that point, every nation state on the planet said, well, we can't trust the U.S. If we're not politically aligned with their meme, we might lose our deposits. And now we see gold as the number one reserve currency, central banks worldwide. So I digress, but that point is very important.
Let me stop you there, because something interesting just happened there. Boy, I'm so sorry that we're making this all about China, but there's a third headline coming out of China today. My notes here are that China is buying so much gold that they've added 15 metric tons of gold within the last, I don't know how many months, but apparently China's on a gold buying spree right now, just as the price of gold is so low. I'm sorry to throw that in there, but it had to do with the point you were making. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but if you'd like to comment on that, please do.
Yeah, well, the old adage, he who owns the gold makes the rules, and if you follow gold around the world, you will find the Austrian school has a really good take on how the economy works on a global basis. So let's go back a few steps.
Okay.
If you go back World War One, you're looking at the Great Britain, the greatest empire at one time on the planet. And they owned most of the gold. Hmm. Then you go, and they produced the most. So it's production and the money flows, and consider gold money. So the money flows to who produces the most goods and services. That was Great Britain at one time.
Yeah.
Then World War II, it shifted to the United States. The United States outproduced everybody by far, and who got the most gold? The United States of America. Now, who produces the most? China. And where's the gold going? China. So you can follow the money. It's really, I would say, elementary, but most people don't analyze markets basis, you know, true money versus, you know, all the, I won't say nonsense, but the markets that we're dwelled with every day, how good the economy is based on markets. Markets are not the economy. Markets can do well while the economy suffers. In, let's go back to 1950, 60, maybe into the 70s, the Dow Jones actually was a pretty good indicator of how well the economy was doing.
Yeah.
We lost that through the 80s to present day. The economy could take off and look great with the stock market, and the politicians could brag about it, while the people are suffering and not able to buy, let's say, what they used to as far as housing, insurance, gasoline, et cetera.
Yeah, you know, it's funny what you just said, because it's such a logical endomime as you look at it, both geopolitically and, I suppose, economically. You said that at one time, the Brits ran the world, they were the biggest empire, and they had the most gold. Then along came our country, yours and mine, the United States, and we had the biggest economy and we own all the gold. Now, according to most estimates, China is about to become the biggest economy in the world in the next 4 or 5 years, depending on, you know, who you read. And guess what? They're going to own all the gold. That's fascinating, the way you were able to put that together. And yet, for the average person, right, living anywhere in the world, it doesn't mean that much, does it? Because they're not, the average person's not out there buying gold. The average person's just living their life. What's the effect on them of this change?
Well, because they are not really educated in how gold works in the real economy, they're too busy working for a living to tune into this stuff. I mean, hopefully they watch your show and learn something. And I'm sure everybody that does has learned a great deal. And I commend you for what you're doing, because
thank
it
you.
Really is about truth. And we need to know the truth before we cannot solve a problem without a very explicit definition of the problem. Mm. And the problem is that we're lying to everyone because the system is based on a lie. And the lie is what you've taught your kids and I've taught my kids is you can't get something for nothing. Mm-hmm. And yet the entire system is based on creating paper money, or really digital money. It's a digital world. Out of nothing,
yeah.
By a few banking elite, but I digress. So the gold imports into China are extremely valid, and we do not know how much they have. Many of the analysts, many of my peer group do believe strongly and build a strong case that cannot be proven that the amount of gold in China exceeds the amount of gold in the United States that, of course, recently Bessent said, oh, it's all there, trust me. We, you know, somebody looked at it. I mean, it's nonsense. It has been audited since I was born in 1953. But again, I'll give it back to you.
All of the assets that are non-conforming assets or non-normal assets, for lack of a better term, let's talk about gold. Let's talk about silver. Let's talk about Bitcoin and perhaps some other digital assets. It's not what most people invest in, and yet it's what a lot of people are investing in. At this particular time, I know gold is way down, looking at it in terms of what I saw this morning from a six-month standpoint. Bitcoin's down. I believe silver's down. So all these things are down, and yet you and I are sitting here talking about how people and governments are going to be buying them and are, in fact, buying them. How do you reconcile those two things? Why are they so low if they're so important?
Well, it depends on your perspective. Everything you said is correct. But really, you got to look at what is real money? What is sound money?
Yeah.
And it, historically, from the Roman Empire, before that even, it's been gold and silver. Now, think about what gold is. If you take a gold ounce, whether it's a Krugerrand or a Britannia or U.S. Eagle, whatever, that ounce of gold is an ounce of gold, regardless of what government stamped it.
Yeah.
That is a constant. That gold mass, that 1 ounce, never changes. It's the same mass throughout the universe forever.
Yep.
So what changes? And what changes is the price. And what's the price based on? Confidence. Confidence in the U.S. dollar, primarily. Hmm. So really, we've got a con game going. And we're going to lose the battle, and it's always been lost, 100% of the time up until now. Every fiat currency that's ever been tried across the entire planet has failed. Hmm. Will this one fail? I do not believe it will fail totally.
You mean
what will happen before it fails?
You mean, by the way, you mean
just to
clear up for our viewers, when you talk about fiat currency, in case people don't understand it, and when you're talking about this particular currency, you're talking about the U.S. dollar, right?
Correct.
Go, continue.
Thanks for the clarification.
Of course.
So we're in that system. I'll give it back to you, but we are in dire straits, and mathematically, there's no way out of this. Politicians could say whatever they want about markets. They could talk about GDP. A lot of the GDP is just growth of the money supply. A lot of the new highs in the stock market are a result of growth of the money supply. Huh. A lot of these things that political class points to saying, oh, we're doing fine, when the American people are generally suffering, the middle class is getting wiped out. They know better. They will buy into the fact that there is inflation. They're not buying the government's statistics.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's talk about the U.S. dollar, because something else has happened. It's a headline that I think is tangible, or that I think flows into this conversation very well. As we know, and I think as a lot of my friends and maybe your friends who are military analysts will tell you, the United States, for the first time in a long time, is directly losing a war to an opponent, and that opponent is Iran. For whatever reason, whether you want to look at it kinetically or geopolitically or however you want to look at it. And as a result, the Iranians are now telling the world, we don't only want to defeat the United States, we want to defeat the United States' banking system because of what they've done to us. We want to defeat the dollar, we want to defeat their currency, et cetera, et cetera. And just today, as Mr. Trump says he's going to pile it on for the fifth night in a row and bomb the hell out of Iran, Iran has put out an ultimatum. And I have this. It's a headline right here that basically says, if you hit our oil facilities, if you hit, our power network, like Mr. Trump threatened last night that he would do, we are going to tell the Houthis in Yemen to close the Strait of Al-Mandab. Now, this would be huge, because we already know the Strait of Hormuz is closed. If the Houthis, i.e. Yemen, start bombing and shut down the Strait of Al-Mandab, we would have an even bigger economic problem, not just for the world, but for the United States. And it's, again, advantage Iran. What does that do to the U.S. position? By the way, there's the map. There's the Strait of Hormuz. There's the Strait of Al-Mandab. It goes into the all the way up to the Suez Canal and into the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. Obviously, the Strait of Hormuz stops at the Persian Gulf, for those of you looking at the map as we're talking. So my question to you, David, is what is the effect on these kinds of things on currency, on the U.S. currency, for example, on the United States economy?
Well, everyone believes, or almost everyone, that the world runs on money. The old adage, money makes the world go round. And that's what most people think. But it's not true. The truth is that money is secondary. Energy is what runs the world. Hmm. Without energy, absolutely nothing happens. So that's the lifeblood of the world economy. So with the Strait of Hormuz having the issues it's had now since February, and with this, what you just proposed as happening or could happen, you're cutting off an energy supply, which means you're cutting off the lifeblood to the global economy. So what are you going to get as an end result? It depends how long it lasts. But you could certainly, and I hate to even use the word, but you're asking, I'll tell you, I don't hold back. You're looking at a worldwide depression at some point, depending about how long this lasts.
Worldwide depression. Draw a picture for me. What does that look like? It hasn't happened in my life.
Well, you're not able to grow as much food because you're not getting as much energy. You're not, you know, a lot of petrochemicals are used as fertilizers, you know.
Yeah.
So you're not going to grow as much food. So all of a sudden, you know, the breadbasket of the U.S., et cetera, that extra food supply that we ship out, you know, won't be as robust as it was in years past. So that's going to be a constraint. Then you're going to see less, you know, mobility because of less energy. So you're going to see what could happen during the 70s that I'm aware of with, you know, reposting the speed limits in the United States to save fuel. You could have something like that take place, you know, nation state by nation state. I don't know the exact outcome as far as, you know, exact ideas, but what I do know is the big picture. And the big picture is a huge decline in the standard of living on a global basis. Now, there may be areas like the Middle East that has so much abundant oil that it doesn't affect them very much. But on a global basis, it has a huge effect. Oil makes the world go round. You have less oil, less energy, you're going to have less economic activity, and you're going to have a lower standard of living.
This is kind of a quasi-political question, but my dad always used to tell me, son, if you don't walk with your eyes open, you're going to step in a bucket of crap. And it seems to me that we, in this situation in Iran, have kind of stepped in a bucket of crap. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, war serves very little purpose. There's very little positivity at any time in history. And yet, you know, the human race continues to go into these wars. No, I can't add to that too much, Rick. I just think that there's one subset that very few people know about, and that is how the global empires run through the banking elite. There's only three entities that aren't aligned with the current banking system. That's Iran, South Korea, and Cuba. Isn't that fascinating? So those three basically are outside of the conventional world banking system. Something to think about.
So let's talk about the average Joe out there, or the average Josephine, I suppose, no matter where they might
be. Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt. I said South Korea. I meant North Korea. I'm sorry.
I've done that myself, so don't worry about it. And thank you for the correction. Let's talk about the average Joe or the average Josephine out there, and they're thinking, this guy's really smart. He certainly knows a lot about the world situation. That's what makes most good investors good investors. They're ahead of the game. What do I do? What do I do if I'm living in Kansas and I've got a job and I got a pretty good job? I make $100,000 a year. I got a little bit of money to put away. How do I protect myself? How do I protect my family for now and for the future?
Well, number one, as trite as it may sound, and it's more and more difficult to do it, but one is live within your means. Two is basically save for your, you know, what you want. I mean, if you want a new car or whatever, it's better to buy it outright than to make payments. But I would, what I have taught through the years, and that is to save in real money. So if your savings account was a bank account, it's secure, it's your bank, you trust it, it's FDIC insured, and all the stuff we hear every day, all of that's true, but you're holding something that's depreciating value almost daily. But if you would be stacking silver as an example, or gold is even better, you would have a CAGR, a compounded annual growth rate of about 8 or 9%. And that's far better than the T-bill, which is the 10-year T-bill, or T-note, that, you know, most people covet as like the sacrosanct best, most safest investment in the world. And it's not. So if you were able to save your savings in real money, right now, looking at the value of silver, 50 cents an hour in 90% silver coins is equivalent to $21 in fiat. That shows you how bad the money has been destroyed. Because we were still circulating silver quarters when I was a kid. Of course, I'm a little bit older. But the idea is that why is 50 cents in coin that's real money equivalent to 21 Federal Reserve notes?
So rank them for us. Let's look at these. Gold, silver, Bitcoin, the market. What am I missing? What should I be looking at if I am not a multimillionaire guy like Elon Musk? I'm just a guy with a job and I want to invest in something. Rank those for us, would you?
All right, the market. First of all, as you said before, the market is not the economy.
Right.
And some of the best performing markets have been after a currency failure. If you look at Venezuela, you look at Zimbabwe, you look at what their stock markets did after the currency failed, they had the best performing stock markets of anyone else. But that doesn't mean they were really having great economic activity. So you got to distinguish between the market and the economy. That's number one. Number two is you've got to realize that this system is broken and it will not be fixed. It's a confidence game getting near the end. More and more people are talking about the debasement trade. I talked about debasement on the first interview I ever gave. Now it's popular. Back then, no one wanted to hear that the dollar is losing value. The dollar is not going away. It's not collapsing. But it's gradually losing its relative dominance, remaining as the world's primary currency. And that trend continues. Go back 20 years, it was about 78% of the global activity. Now it's something like 58%. So dollar dominance is key, and it's being lost. I'll stop there.
That's a good place to stop. So the dollar loses it. The U.S. currency loses its value. China's kind of helping to do that. And so are other countries. So when it goes down, what goes up? Is that where digital currency and Bitcoin will find its place? Is that where gold and silver find its place? Or does it actually push down those others as well? What happens? What's the reciprocal effect?
At the end of all great inflations, people are smart. People protect themselves. People have ingenuity. So at the end of all great inflations, the people themselves come up with ideas to counterbalance the effects of an inflationary depression. So you go back to like the depression, there were wooden nickels, there were contracts made within communities that they traded themselves or bartered. Same thing here. So I would say the advent of the cryptocurrency world was a direct reflection of what was happening with the US dollar. So that's one big key that, look, we're looking for an alternative to keep our savings in or as a payment vehicle outside of the conventional means. So that's a very good example right there. Gold and silver have held a test of time for thousands of years. So obviously they're part of the equation as well.
I imagine you would tell people that they should invest not for tomorrow or not for the next day or not for next week, but if they believe in something, they need to hold on to it. Isn't that the way people who make real money make their money?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up because this is something I thought earlier in our conversation. If you look at legacy wealth, you look at the very wealthy, the elites, whatever, there's only three things they do: land, gold, and fine art. Fine art is for the ultra rich. I have no idea about investing in it.
I can't afford, I can't afford a Picasso either, by the way. So just in case.
Right. But that's the idea. So, you know, if you're taught that in school, you know, you had your first idea about money and where it came from and who controls it and all that. And that just the legacy wealth is based on those three things, or just say two that, you know, kids would understand: gold and land. You know, what a concept. I mean, very, very simple. But as you know, Europeans have the idea and they say never sell the mud. Meaning they own the land. If they own it generation to generation, there might be, let's say one time, an apartment building on it. And then maybe 100 years later, there's a grocery store on it or something. The point being is that you never give it up. It's a long-term buy and hold, you know, idea. And that's true of gold. Not that you don't spend some of it or, you know, utilize it or whatever, but nonetheless. And that is, again, is not taught. No one really wants to tell you that the system is rigged against most people. No, they're never going to tell you that.
But there's something else, and maybe this is where we finish. Now I'm going to have you be a social psychologist for us and answer this question from a social psychological point of view. Because I grew up poor. I was an immigrant kid who came from Cuba, and I grew up with my mom and dad. My dad worked in a factory, and my mom worked sewing shoes. And, you know, my brothers and I went to public school, and I was lucky because America's a great country for people like me, and I was able to become prosperous. Wealthy enough, you know, but the idea of money has always made me uncomfortable. And a lot of people out there, when we think of money, it scares the hell out of us. We don't know where to start. We don't know how to look at it. We don't know how to use it. We don't know how to manipulate it. So we kind of fear it. Do you understand that? What advice would, because you seem so comfortable talking about it, what advice would you give to people out there who have that perspective? And that's a lot of people. I would say most.
Yeah, that's very good. Well, this is going to sound like a shameless plug, but I'll just put it out there because you hit my heart. I did a documentary. It's called Silver Sunrise. It's available for free. It's at silversunrise.tv. Uh-huh. The basic premise of that movie is the control and manipulation the powers have over us with money and how to overcome it. And my main theme is that to put money in its proper perspective. Everything that we're taught is about what is success. And success is taught as everything external to ourselves. the right job, the right car, the right apartment, the right neighborhood, the right education, the right clothes, the right watch. Everything is external. And what I want to do is turn that pyramid upside down and say, you being born as a human being are enough. You have everything you need. You have more capacity than you can imagine. And get these kids from the ground up understanding that they in and of themselves are enough. And everything outside of that is external. You can be a very successful janitor if your head's on straight.
Yeah.
It's not about how much you own. It's how much you have. And what I mean by how much you have, it's your spirit. It's your head and your heart. I'm not saying you don't have to make a living. What I am saying is that you have it upside down. We're prioritizing money over people. When we are in a situation like that, we have our society backwards. Remember what made America great? I'm not certain I have it 100%. But when I was in the movie, the Four Horsemen film, and I was talking about great America and how great it was. This is way before MAGA. And we're talking about 14, 15 years ago. And I said, America used to be great. We used to have this. We used to do that. But what made America great was integrity. We lived our word. We didn't have a president that jumped up and down and all around every other day saying we're on, we're off, we're up, we're down. I mean, this is insanity. Hmm. And it just is a reflection of us, the people. I mean, we could blame ourselves because we have not taken responsibility to be vigilant enough to fight for the one thing that means more than any amount of money, any amount of gold in the world, and that is our freedom. And if we're losing that, we've lost everything. And it doesn't matter what your stack looks like. It doesn't matter if you're a billionaire or not. If you lost the ability to do what we were given at the beginning of this nation, a constitutionally secured right to be free, we've lost everything.
Amen. Damn. Those are powerful words. Those are powerful words. I'm telling you, David, that's important. And I'm glad you shared that, because that is the root of what Americans need to focus on at a time when they're being driven in so many bizarre directions. By the way, if somebody does want to reach out to you, tell them how they can reach out to you. And tell us once again, the you said it was a silversunrise.tv. Is that right?
Correct.
That's documentary.
The way they could get a hold of... I'm sorry.
It's a documentary?
It is.
Cool. Continue. Yeah.
To learn more, just go to the main website. It's themorganreport.com. There's a three-step process. Step one is the free newsletter. Step two is the two documentaries. There's a quick link to both of them in box two. And box three is if you want to consult or join the behind the paywall where I do my investment analysis and provide a newsletter.
You are a delight to talk to, and you seem like a really good man. I'm so happy that I had an opportunity to share some time with you, and thank you for being so gracious with your time. We certainly appreciate it. Thanks again, Dave. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for giving me the platform. I really appreciate it.
That is really an interesting perspective. I mean, as people who are living in this particular time of wars and bizarre stuff and all these tariffs and countries after each other and the situation that we're seeing in the Middle East and the corruption level in my country alone and David and our country is like nothing I've ever seen before. We're left to ask ourselves, what do we do? Where do we turn? Who do we talk to? And there's a sane voice, There's a guy who's able to put things in perspective. The kind of reminds me of the way my dad used to talk about things, that it's all about the fundamentals. You got to go back down to the earth, I think at one point he said the mud. He's right. That's it for us. You can find us, of course, on X and on YouTube and on Spotify and on BitChute. And I want to thank you all for being there. And most of all, I want to thank you for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll be looking for you next time.